It's an honor to, for the Heterodox Academy campus communities at Cornell University and at City Portland and the Cornell Political Union to sponsor GADSAT here tonight. GAD is an outspoken advocate for using evidence-based, logical, rational thinking, owned and directed by free speech, to solve real-world problems. He is adamantly opposed to basing solutions on postmodernist theory, which denies objective reality. DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion, or DEI, is based on postmodernist thinking, which rejects rational thinking while censoring offensive speech. DEI is incompatible with free speech necessary to hone and correct thinking based on objective reality. Postmodernist university, Cornell conflates anti-Semitism with Islamophobia to solve a number of problems associated with October 7th and Patrick Dye's online threats. Cornell's solution is to point to white supremacy as a cause and diversity, equity, and inclusion as a solution. When Cornell announced that it was looking for speakers to address anti-Semitism, I suggested Bill Jacobson from the Cornell Law School and Cornell alum God said, yes, huh? I was told, Bill, thank you. Because neither of them did research on anti-Semitism. I beg to differ. I suggest that each of you read Bill Jacobson's blog, Legal Insurrection, follow GAD on Twitter or X, watch The Sad Truth on YouTube, and read GAD-SAD's book, The Parasitic Mind, and his future book, Suicidal Empathy. I think you'll see that Cornell would have benefited by listening to these two heterodox thinkers. I would like to announce that Sunday, April 14th, there will be the largest gathering of Jews in Cornell's history on the Art Squad. And for more information, reach out to Cornellians for Israel at CornellIsraelRally@gmail.com. If you don't get that, email me. With that, I'd like to introduce GADSAD, a Cornell alum who got his MS and PhD in 1993 and 1994 with Jay Russo, who's sitting right there. Here. Yesterday you heard about how much GAD loves Cornell, how much he's loved, now you can see Jay. And then he went on to become the people's professor. So with that, I'd like to introduce GAD.
Hi everybody, it's good to see you. Please, when we go to the Q&A period, don't ask any difficult questions because I need to continue to impress my former doctoral supervisor. So please be gentle on me. So of course, it's terribly disheartening that I even need to be invited to speak about eternal Jew hatred. And as you'll see, I'll describe my personal history, which will, there's another one of my former professors. Thomas Gilovich, look at that. Nice to see you. So I'll walk us through a bit of a personal history, which, so not only have I thought about this in an academic sense, how Jew hatred could be a type of parasitic idea, but certainly given my personal history, yes? Oh, you want to turn it on? Is this better? No? Testing 1, 2, 1, 2? No? Yes? We're good? Okay. So given my personal history, I think I'm well qualified to speak on this topic. So the eternal hatred of Jews from Beirut to the West. Let's start with this. There are two images here that you see. One of them, the colorful one, is the one that I grew up in. Up to the age of 10, and then the civil war broke out in Lebanon, and all butchery is judged in comparison to the unbelievable brutality of the Lebanese civil war. Neighbors became the most fervent enemies from one day to the next. Now, if you were Jewish, it was particularly challenging because there weren't going to be many roadblocks that you would clear. What would happen in Beirut early in the civil war is there'd be random roadblocks set up by different militia, and they would ask you to show your, in Arabic you say hawiyya, your internal ID card. And the most conspicuous thing on your internal ID card is your religion. And Jews was written, it wasn't even written Jewish, which would be in Arabic Yahudi, it was written Israeli, which means Israelite. So if there wasn't enough animus for you for being Jewish, then we're going to ramp it up by making you an Israelite. And so you really couldn't go anywhere. Death awaited you around every corner. Luckily, we escaped after the first year of the Civil War. And so I'll tell you about some of the stories that I thought were in my rear view mirror for the past many decades. But boy, have they come back to haunt me today. And certainly after October 7th, the level of Jew hatred that I've experienced has been truly astounding. So buckle up. So this story, I call it, well, because it's death to Jews, death to Jews. And if you see there, there's a picture of a gentleman holding a sign saying death to all Jews. If you're going to call for a genocidal extermination, at least have the decency to pronounce us, I mean, to spell us correctly. So that became a famous meme where usually when I say, for example, Shabbat Shalom, I will write to all of the evil Jews in reference to that particular meme. Now, the gentleman to my left is Gamal Abdel Nasser, who was the president of Egypt. He was a pan-Arabist trying to unify all of the Arab states. He was very much loved and respected in the Arab world. Well, in 1970, he passed away when I was 5. I wasn't quite 6 years old yet. And the reason why I tell this story is because, as so often happens in the Middle East, when one of these figures passes away, people take to the streets in these very feverish demonstrations. And when people were passing by our house in the thousands, all I could hear as a 5-year-old boy was death to Jews, death to Jews. Now, it wasn't clear to me why the call death to Jews was happening when I was 5 years old, because an Egyptian president had passed away. But that's, and so when you hear about Lebanon having been the Paris of the Middle East, and it was so progressive and tolerant and so on, yes, in comparison to the rest of the Middle East, but in comparison to what the Western mind can understand, then it's certainly not very tolerant. Jew hatred is embedded within the DNA of the societies in the Middle East, as I will explain in several of these next slides. This is actually a photo from one of my school. This is me right here, okay? And in that photo, I don't know why I grant that kid the courtesy to not identify him, 50 years later, but the teacher had asked us to stand up and tell the class what we wish to be when we grew up. And this is before the Civil War. There was no Civil War. This is around probably 73, 74. So one kid gets up, I want to be a policeman, I want to be a doctor, I want to be a soccer player. And one kid gets up, knowing that there is a Jewish kid who's supposedly his friend in the class. He says, when I grow up, I want to be a Jew killer, to the raucous applause and laughter of everyone in the room. Now, that wasn't, due to the October 7th crisis. It wasn't because of the Zionist occupation. My family had never been to Israel. My extended family, there's a lot of my family that lives in Israel for many years, but certainly my nuclear family had never been to Israel. We had nothing to do with Israel. So the I want to be a Jew killer was certainly not because he was resisting the occupation. My brother was an Olympian in 1976. These are the actual newspapers from Lebanon. David Saad right here, champion of Lebanon. So for several years in a row, my brother had been Lebanese national champion in judo. And it became a bit embarrassing for the relevant authorities that a Jew was constantly winning the competitions. And so he was visited by some men that explained to him that it was time for him to retire, or else, some accidents can happen. And then he ended up leaving to Paris, France, to continue his judo training. He was never allowed to represent Lebanon because he was Jewish. This is tolerant, progressive Paris of the Middle East, Lebanon. But interestingly, they forgave him for being Jewish when in 1976 at the Montreal Olympics, they were more than happy to have him represent proudly the Lebanese flag. I think he was only one of five members on the Olympic team that represented Lebanon. So the Lebanese Jewish kid who was forced to leave Lebanon then represented Lebanon a couple of years later. This is an actual photo of my parents when they got married in 1950. On one of the return trips, so we emigrated to Canada at the end of the 1975. They kept going back to Lebanon, which wasn't a very rational decision, but they still had business interests and so on. So even after we had emigrated to Montreal, they would go back and forth from Montreal to Beirut. And on one of their trips, this is in full-fledged civil war in 1980, they were kidnapped by Fatah, one of the Palestinian groups. And then it's only because of our family's connections, everything in the Middle East happens, you know, if you have the appropriate connections. Miraculously, we were able to get them out. I think they spent 8 days in captivity. Some really, really bad things happened to them. And then since 1980, none of our family has ever returned, even though I have been invited subsequent to, you know, becoming a professor and, you know, known and so on by even, you know, prime minister's office and so on. But I've never felt sufficiently. I was invited to apply. They wanted me to apply for a deanship of a business school in Lebanon. I don't know if that would have been a trap, but I probably would have lasted 14 seconds after arriving and landing in Beirut. So this is the reality of being Jewish in the Middle East in the best of circumstances. Lebanon truly was the most tolerant place for Jews out of all of the Middle East. So if you look, I'll show you some slides about how Jews have fared in the rest of the Middle East. Now this is a very powerful story. I'm going to wear my glasses. So I'm going to read you first in chapter one of The Parasitic Mind. This was the talk that I gave yesterday. This was one of my books in 2020. In order to kind of introduce why some of these issues interest me, for example, identity politics and so on, there is no society that is more a perfect exemplar of identity politics than Lebanon. Everything is based on your religious heritage. The number of people that serve in parliament depends, so you get a certain number of people that are Maronites, that are Sunni Muslim, that are this. But you can't. You have one seat for Jews, which is now, of course, not filled. But you certainly could never be president or prime minister in Lebanon. Both positions are there. And so this is a story. I tell many personal stories in The Parasitic Mind. I'm just going to read you this verbatim, and then I'm going to link it to something that happened just a few months ago. So the next memory that I have is perhaps one of the most poignant ones of my life. The flight captain declared that we were out of Lebanese airspace. This is literally the day that we're flying out of Lebanon to Montreal via Copenhagen. So the flight captain declared that we were out of Lebanese airspace, at which point my mother took out a chain with a Star of David, or it could have been a chai. I can't exactly remember. I'm almost certain that it's a Star of David. And then she placed it around my neck and said, now you can wear this, not hide your identity, and be proud of who you are. So this was, I mean, literally within a few minutes of flying out of Lebanon. Now I'm going to read you what happened a few months ago that also relates to a Star of David. I was just picked up. This happened on October 21st, and that's why I took the screenshot of the tweet. I was just picked up by my wife, who had taken our son to a soccer match. When I got into the car, this is what my son said to me. If you were wearing a Magen David, a Star of David, Daddy, you'd be dead, in reference to where he had just played the match. This is in Montreal, Canada, in the east end of the city, which comes with a particular demographic reality. I'll leave you to all very bright Cornelians to think what that demographic reality might be. And so the Star of David had come full circle. I left Lebanon you can wear the Star of David proudly. Almost 50 years later, you better not wear a Star of David in Montreal, Daddy, or you'd be dead. I've told my son to not say that he's Jewish when he plays soccer matches in many places in Montreal. But people merrily go on picking up their tomatoes and cooking their meals while the monster comes. Okay. I won't go through all of these, but the top number shows you the number of Jews that used to be in Lebanon in one particular time period and the number of Jews that remain. So some of the numbers you want to look at: how many Jews in Libya? Zero. How many in Egypt? About 100. By the way, my brother-in-law's family are Egyptian Jews from Alexandria. There's no longer any Jews in Egypt. There's almost no Jews in Algeria, very few in Morocco, very few in Tunisia, almost none in Syria. Some of my grandparents come from Syria. There's one estimate places the number of Jews in my homeland of Lebanon at about 40, but these are 40 Jews that no longer display their allegiance to Jews. So they got married to some Christian woman in 1957. So yes, they are technically Jewish, but there's no Jewish community. So the only place where there is any semblance of some sort of Jewish community is in Iran. Okay? But again, even there, be quiet, Jew, right? So we tolerate you until, inshallah, one day we won't tolerate you. That's the reality. Here is a Pew survey that shows, so Pew surveys are certainly respectable, they're certainly nonpartisan. It shows you the percentage of polled people from those, and by the way, it applies to all the other countries in that region. What is the endemic Jew hatred in those societies? Well, if I would have told you, well, you know, 10% of the polled people have bad views of the Jews, well, you would say, wow, 10% is a big number. What if I told you that most of those societies have 95 to 99% Jew hatred? So now, if you let in 500,000 people from those societies into your culture, and yes, I don't have to preface it with most people who are of the Islamic faith are lovely, and I literally have many Muslim friends, more than any of you have ever met. That doesn't mean that if you come with a certain set of baggage, culturally and religiously, that that's not going to be a problem. If 95 to 99% of people that are polled have a very ugly view of Jews, and then there is a massive increase of such people in your society, it doesn't probably take a fancy professor to tell you that we can predict that Jew hatred will increase. Okay? It really is that simple. This is the Noble United Nations. This is from a few years ago, but the data is probably worse now since October 7th. It lists the number of countries that have received condemnations from the United Nations versus the number of condemnations that Israel has received. You know, last I checked, there were quite a few nasty people in the neighborhood. There's just North Korea, there is China, there is maybe Yemen is not very nice. Maybe there's all kinds of really nasty folks around the world. Well, it turns out that the total number of condemnations, rest of the world is 55. Israel has more condemnations than the entire world combined. That seems like a pretty fair and unbiased body. So Jew hatred is truly the canary in the coal mine. It's not, of course, it's not the only hatred that exists. A lot of people will write to me on social media, well, why do you focus on Jew hatred? Well, maybe because I'm Jewish and I am the recipient of how we're going to put you in the oven, Jew. That doesn't mean, of course, that doesn't negate the fact that there's an endless other forms of hatred, but there is something uniquely insidious and existentially diabolical about Jew hatred. And I could certainly spend several hours talking about why that is the case. And there is an expression, a saying in the Middle East, first we come for the Saturday people, and then we come for the Sunday people. So the hatred may start with the Jews, but we're coming for you next. So the idea of, if I bury my head in the sand, it's going to go away, it won't go away. And there's 1,400 years of history that couldn't be any clearer. If I made up the data, I couldn't make it up to be as unequivocally clear as that. But Westerners, you see, are very lovely and tolerant and kind, and so they don't like to hear such words. I'm all for immigration. I'm an immigrant, right? So I don't need to be lectured about the beauty of immigration. But it has to be immigrants who share in your deontological values. If the immigrants say, once we become the majority, your freedoms will no longer be the same, then maybe we need to pay a bit of attention to that. So there are three fundamental sources of Jew hatred. There is the academic left, the oppressed oppressor binary, which is taught at every single Near East department in Canada and the US and the West in general, or political science department. And so that creates a certain animus towards, they say Zionists, but that's not true. It's Jews. Okay? And then there is the ultra-right kind of white nationalist, the Charlottesville guys, Jews won't replace us gang. And then number three are, of course, the Islamic sources of Jew hatred. And after October 7th, what really amazed me was the extent to which everywhere I turned, left, right, and center, I just couldn't keep up with the amount of Jew hatred that I was receiving. And it's not, I'm a very straight-talking person, but I'm not unnecessarily inflammatory. I don't go out of my way to insult individual people. I criticize broad things, ideologies. And if you see the stuff, you wouldn't believe the kind of stuff I receive. I receive it from all three gangs, but I'll probably focus a lot more on the third one, since that's my background. This is my reality at my university. I wrote an article that really upset my administration. Why are you writing about the Jew hatred that you're facing at your university? That's what upset them. Not the fact that many Jewish students over the past 10 years have come to me furtively and looking around saying, I'm afraid to ever wear a kippah or Star of David on campus. My university has been referred to colloquially as Gaza University for over 20 years. But that didn't impress my administrators. What impressed them is, why are you making so much noise, Jew boy? They didn't say the Jew boy, but that's the sentiment. Okay? Well, why are you writing these national articles that are read by many people in Canada? It's making us look bad. Just shut up. Oh, and by the way, let's try to create a world where we eradicate Islamophobia. So if the Jewish students and Jewish professors contact the administration to say that, we're afraid to come to campus, then the president of the university releases a statement saying that it's really important that we fight against Islamophobia. And the reason why he does that is because numbers matter. Jews are now a much smaller population in Montreal than Islamic students, and therefore you dance to your greater constituency, right? The photo on the right, or to my right, is riot police, Montreal police. This is not campus police. Even though your campus police is actually a real police, you have guns. Our campus police is just part-time guys that carry walkie-talkies. But these are armed riot gear that are standing outside the university to protect Jewish students and Jewish professors. As far as it is for me, being rather high profile at this point, it's almost impossible for me to go to campus. So many of the classes I taught last semester, I had to do them via Zoom. Now I'm on sabbatical, and so I have a bit of a respite, but September is going to come around and we'll see what happens then. I mentioned this yesterday at yesterday's talk when I spoke about the parasitic mind. My wife, in her concern about my safety, has come to many of my classes where she walks around me as though she's a 6'4" guard, looking around everywhere to make sure that who's going to come and knife me. This is not happening in Sana'a, Yemen. This is not happening in Lahore, Pakistan. This is happening in Montreal, Canada. And you can blow it away and, well, that doesn't really affect me, but it will affect you. In 5 minutes, in 5 years, or in 500 years, it will affect you. There are 56 countries today that used to once think it won't affect them. And today, they're almost 100% Islamic. This is a copy of my latest book, The Sad Truth About Happiness, 8 Secrets for Leading the Good Life. And then one of the really noble and lovely straight out of Nazi iconography memes that have been released is The Sad Truth About the Talmud. Look at how I look, diabolical, parasitic. 8 Secrets for Enslaving the Goyim, best-selling author of The Parasitic Jew. It's straight out of Nazi talk. I have 100,000 of these. You could not worry about it. You're in Ithaca. No, it doesn't matter here. It will matter. So let me tell you about Ithaca. Some of you may have heard that story because it's part of the lore now, but some of you may have not, so let me mention it. My time at Cornell was magical. I need to infinitely thank this lovely mentor who trained me how to think, so I owe him a lot. Thomas Gilovich was a professor of mine for one of my courses. And so all my professors here, everything, the whole ecosystem at Cornell, I couldn't have hoped for better training. Truly, I'm not saying it because I'm at Cornell. Although I have also criticized Ithaca generally for being super woke, right? BLM signs, transgender of color people, lives matter, love is love, and the rest of the stuff. But Cornell is a gorgeous place. I certainly didn't face much Jew hatred when I was here many years ago. But this is what happened the first semester I got here. So I quickly became friends with a bunch of Arabic students through a Lebanese contact. And we used to always go and play pickup soccer together here on campus. And one of the friends, who's a Arabic, a Muslim guy, invited me once to get together for coffee. I don't know if some of you remember Café Décadence. This was in College Town, just before Aladdin's, which also I regret to have found out no longer exists. These are some of the places we used to hang out. And so I went out with this student who was doing his master's in engineering. And we were sitting around just chatting, and first he said, well, you know, Gad, you seem like to be a very bright person. Oh, thank you. How come you haven't converted to Islam yet? I said, oh, is this why we're having coffee at Decadence? Because the conversation is not going to go well if you're trying to proselytize. He said, no, it's okay. So he realized, okay, that's off the topic. Then later we were chatting, and he sort of pensively looked at me and said, you know, Gad, I really like you. I said, why do you say that with a bit of surprise? Oh, I know why. I'm not going to even mention his name, although he doesn't deserve the courtesy of me not mentioning his name. I said, oh, you're surprised that you really like me because I'm Jewish? By the way, they're all Arabic speaker, and Arabic is my mother tongue, so we always spoke in Arabic, and I was a very good soccer player. So I said, oh, is it you like me because you're surprised that you like me because I'm Jewish? And he said, well, no, but I mean, Gad, you're not a Jew-Jew. I said, oh, no, I'm a Jew-Jew-Jew-Jew. And he said, no, come on, you know what I mean. So let's analyze what that logic is. I've been bred, I'm speaking as him now, I've been bred straight out of the womb that the Jew is the cause of all calamities. Then I meet one such Jew who speaks Arabic, who's just as Arabic as me, who's a much better soccer player than all of us combined, who's fun, who's sweet. That doesn't go with what I've been taught. So I have to remove the marker of him being a true Jew so I can have cognitive consistency, Leon Festinger, right? And so it's a small story compared to the Jew hatred that I receive today. It's nothing, but it captures that mindset, okay? And that happened right here, fall 1990. Of course, the current reality at Cornell has gotten a lot worse. Here we've got our main man trying to, you know, let's go out and kill the Jews. And then here we've got, oh yes, October 7th was so exhilarating, so energizing. Now again, think about what that, the fact that you could stand up, knowing that you are being videotaped, and feel sufficiently emboldened to not self-censor and say, maybe I should not say that. That means the winds are changing, right? The zeitgeist is changing. I'm probably on the right side to say there's something energizing, exhilarating about the systematic killing of 1,300 people. It's exciting. It invigorates me, right? And now I hear that he's back at work. Is that correct? He was put on leave, I think, for one semester. So there you go. That's Cornell. These three clowns, I mean, I won't talk much about it, but I basically argue that, you know, it's window dressing to when these folks step down, because the problem is a lot more endemic than that. It's window dressing. Okay, you step down. But what's the general atmosphere at these universities? It isn't good. It certainly isn't good at Harvard. Maybe it's a bit better here. But there are many, many universities now where it's. I'm not saying that it's dangerous to be Jewish and that you're going to be beheaded, but I know, just because of the platform that I have, I receive endless emails from students who are Jewish from all kinds of universities, who say, "I'm afraid to speak out. If we discuss some topic that's thorny, I just keep my mouth shut." Is that a good thing to have? Probably not. Now, this is just kind of an interesting fact. In the parasitic mind, I talk about whether certain disciplines are inherently more likely to be, you know, more quickly parasitized by bad ideas. And not surprisingly, you know, things like engineering or the business school, to the extent that there's an autocorrective mechanism that's coupled to reality, you're less likely to be parasitized in those fields than in some of the humanities and some of the other social sciences, where you can have all kinds of esoteric theories that are completely removed from reality. Well, the same kind of principle applies to Jew hatred, so that in the business school and in economics and law, you're much more likely to condemn Hamas and support, you know, either condemn or support Hamas. Well, in business and economics, it seems to be reasonable. In STEM, it seems to be reasonable. But look what happens in the humanities and social sciences. If they were truly some deontological truth that were there, you would think that people would be choosing A or B, irrespective of which discipline they're in. But the fact that in some disciplines you could have a complete reversal of how they view reality and through which prism they view it suggests that there is some indoctrination going on in some of these disciplines. Here is what usually is being taught at, I'll first read the tweet, and then I will comment about the image to the right. So let me provide you with the syllabus of every Near East Studies course on Israel at every Western university. You ready? I'm going to save you 4 years of tuition. Prior to 1948, Jews and Arabs lived in beautiful, peaceful, noble, inclusive Palestine. There was zero Jew hatred in the Middle East. As a matter of fact, Islam reveres the Jews. There is a bunch of bloodthirsty white Zionists from Europe with zero claims to that land who created terrorism and ethnically cleansed the noble Palestinians who had accepted the Jews and protected them. Over the past 75 years, the Zionists have committed a genocide, it's actually a daily genocide, on people who simply wish to live in peace. The Zionists are modern-day Nazis, indistinguishable from those Nazis who exterminated the Jews, albeit the Jews have greatly exaggerated the number of Jews killed so that they can garner sympathy points. So that's, I mean, that's, I'm not being hyperbolic or satirical. That really captures inherently the ongoing narrative at every department. That's in Princeton and at Brown and at Yale and at Cornell and the rest of them. Now, the picture on the right, the adage, a picture is worth a thousand story, exists because it exactly is that. Here's what you see in that picture. You see Farah Odeh, who, you know, was a young kid who's throwing a rock on the Zionist Nazi genocidal Jewish tank. And that picture shows a great disparity in power, right? There is the really mean tank, and there is the young, innocent boy. And that then becomes the narrative that drives that dialogue, okay? And, of course, the reality is very, very different from that. But this is what typically people are responding to on university campuses. One of the tools that I use when I engage people in social media, think of it as a form of Socratic method, but in short tweets, I put up these polls to actually get a snapshot picture of what people are truly thinking. So here's one that I posted about three weeks after the October 7th incident. Israel is bombing Gaza today because, one, Jews are inherently genocidal. Two, Hamas slaughtered and raped, well, the number then was 1,400. I think they've downgraded it to 1,200. Israelis on October 7th, 163,119 people voted, and 54% came to the conclusion that it's because Jews are inherently genocidal. And that's what I call the amnesia of causality. There really is nothing that happened October 7th. That particular clock started on October 8th. And based on the October 8th reality, where the timeline begins, then Jews are committing a really ugly genocide. Here are a few more. You are most likely to receive threats if you criticize Judaism, Christianity, Islam, or Buddhism. Well, okay, 57% said Islam, but 37.4% said Judaism. Here's what I propose to do for all 37.4% of people who think it's Judaism. We can test this very easily, right? I can get you to write a very, very punchy tweet criticizing Islam, Muhammad. I can get you to do the same for Judaism. And if you could be so kind as to share your personal address, we can test to see what will happen, whether the Talmudic extremists will come after you or whether it will be noble, peaceful people of perpetual tolerance who will come after you. The most likely converts to commit an act of terror are those who convert to Judaism, Christianity, Hinduism, Islam. Again, Judaism gets a solid 11%. I'd love for you to, if you have some good cases, please email me to my university address of Jewish folks who converted to Judaism and then went on to commit acts of terror, and I'd be happy to reciprocate with the other direction. And then we can bet, if you'd like, $5,000. We could give it to our favorite charity. But that's the reality that you face every day. It's a form of existential gaslighting that's unimaginable. Up is down, left is right, man is woman, peace is war, slavery is freedom, postmodernism. That's why it's the granddaddy of all idea pathogens. I won't go through all this because it's maybe... These are just some of the stuff that I've been told on social media. Oh, maybe it's instructive to go through it. Fine, let's go through it. All right, number one, October 7th never happened. It's not true. Zionist bullshit. October 7th did happen, but it was very, very much exaggerated in terms of the victims. I think there were only 6 people who were killed. October 7th did happen, but it was perfectly justified because occupation. IDF soldiers raped Palestinians, but Hamas doesn't rape anyone. Islam doesn't allow for rape. October 7th happened, but it was orchestrated by Israel in order to have the clearance to commit the genocide. We have clear footage showing that all of the killings were done by the IDF. Since 1948, Israel has been committing a daily genocide on Palestinians. Prior to 1948, Jews and noble Palestinians lived in perfect harmony. Islam loves the Jews. The only problem is Zionism. Zionism is infinitely worse than Islam, and it goes on and on and on. And I mean, these are falsehoods that are at a level that is unimaginable. Zionism has killed more people than Islam throughout history? How? Different estimates place the number of killed, these are conservative estimates, by Islam at 300 million in the last 1,400 years. So Zionism has killed more than 300 million in the last 100 years? How? The truth doesn't matter. I'll skip this. This is some cool quotes from Golda Meir. So now I'm going to link what we're talking about today on Jew hatred with my work on parasitic thinking. It's a real shame that some of you weren't able to make it yesterday, because I really got into how I developed the framework of ideological neuroparasites. But I will briefly explain what the framework is. On the left, you have a wood cricket. This is a hairworm that parasitizes the brain of a wood cricket. These are called neuroparasites, right? Parasites, the field of parasitology, can apply to many places in your body, right? You could have a tapeworm in your intestinal tract. Neuroparasites are those parasites that ultimately seek to, to end up in the brain of its host, altering its neuronal circuitry to suit its reproductive interests, right? And so what the hairworm needs for it to happen, this guy hates water. It instinctively, it doesn't like water. But the hairworm needs it to happily jump into water, commit suicide, because then the hairworm could complete its reproductive cycle. And so when it is parasitized, that's exactly what it does. To its detriment, but to the benefit of the neuroparasite. So now let me show you human parasites, how they look like. Queers for Palestine are the hapless wood cricket that's been parasitized. If you present yourself to the world via your queer identity, and that's great, more power to you, it's probably not a good idea to be supporting Gazan societies, because the Gazan actually have a 100% effective conversion therapy program. It's a gravity-based conversion program. Tel Aviv, on the other hand, happens to be one of the most queer-friendly cities in the world. There is Montreal, there is New York, there is San Francisco. So if I present myself to the world with my queer identity as the first thing forward, then I probably would not want to be saying queers for Palestine. Just like, let me skip to the next slide and I'll come back. We've got chickens for Kentucky Fried Chicken. And since I'm French speaking, this is mine, this is not mine. Geese for foie gras. Okay? But let me go back here. We have here the super progressive, super smarmy and smart Anna Epstein, Jewish Anna Epstein, who walked around on her university, I think it was Boston University, could have been Boston College or Boston University, I think it's Boston University. And she was caught on tape tearing down all the posters of the Jewish babies who had been, so they certainly could not be guilty of any occupation crimes. They're babies. She was taken down in anger because she's progressive. She's more enlightened than all you Cretans. Well, what would have happened to Anna Epstein had she been vacationing in that nice music festival? She doesn't think that far. She's just more progressive than you. But take it from someone who comes from that region, it wouldn't have gone too well for her. That's what a parasitized mind looks like. And I'll give you a few more examples. This really defies logic, but I'm going to read it for you. This comes from my book, The Parasitic Mind. Let me read it. Several years ago, Tal Nitzan, then a doctoral student at Hebrew University, authored an award-winning paper that examined the incidence of rape as perpetrated by the IDF on Palestinian women. Undoubtedly, the goal was to uncover, by the way, Tal Nitzan is Jewish Tal Nitzan. Undoubtedly, the goal was to uncover an epidemic of rape to demonstrate how diabolical those evil Jews truly were. When no such empirical reality was found, not a single documented case was found, it was concluded, you might need to sit down for this, but luckily you're all sitting down. It was concluded that this was proof of the extent to which the Israelis dehumanized the Palestinians. They were so hateful that they did not even consider the Palestinians' women worthy of rapes. If rapes are uncovered, or if none are discovered, the same conclusion is reached. The Israelis are diabolical. All roads lead to self-flagellation and self-loathing. It's the hallmark of a true progressive, right? So if you rape women, you're diabolical. If you don't rape women, you're othering them. You're just as diabolical. So there is no Popperian falsification here. All roads lead to you're diabolical. That's coming from a member of the so-called tribe. You can't win if that's happening. Here's another one, also from the parasitic mind. And incredibly, the woman that is mentioned here, I don't identify who they are. I was giving a similar talk to this one in Montreal, and about a day or two later, this woman wrote to me out of the blue, and so I thought, oh, maybe she was at my talk and I didn't know it, but let me... And it turned out that it wasn't the case. It was just a serendipitous thing. So in 2010, a Canadian Jewish friend contacted me by email to help her better understand Islam, and specifically whether it contained doctrines of hate. At the time, she had a friend who was an apparently lovely Muslim woman who was pursuing a PhD at a leading Canadian university. As commonly occurs with folks infected with OPS, OPS is a malady that I coined in the parasitic mind. It's called ostrich parasitic syndrome. My friend was having a difficult time reconciling her personal interaction with a liberal and peaceful Muslim with the growing evidence of never-ending global mayhem inflicted in the name of Islam. Among much else, I sent her a montage of clips demonstrating the profound Jew hatred found in Islamic societies with children, politicians, imams, clerics, and television personalities spewing nearly unimaginable genocidal hate. Alas, she, along with her friend, responded with a tsunami of cliches. All religions have violent extremists. The Bible contains violent passages. Most Muslims are nice people. That amounted to a nonsensical apologia. And she ended one of our tense email exchanges with, "You're starting to sound fanatical yourself, Gad." Regrettably, she is hardly the only progressive Jew to engage in such disordered thinking when it comes to Islam. She wrote to me about 2-3 days after I had given this talk. And again, I don't think she had been at my talk, and I'm not sure if she had read my book. She goes, "You know, I remember once we had a difficult conversation about this. I wish I would have listened to you then." Right? But it just feels mean-spirited to criticize a religion. It feels gauche. Tolerant, progressive, liberal people should not do that. And then you end up with that conundrum. Yes, most people of a faith are inherently lovely, of course. There are nice Jews and mean Jews, nice Christians, mean Christians, nice Muslims, mean Muslims. But if I'm saying, does Islam contain tenets that are antithetical to free, enlightened societies? You couldn't come up with an ideology that would be more antithetical. You just have to go read it yourself. This is me during COVID. I was speaking at the Jewish Public Library, and some very, very progressive Jews tried to cancel me because they didn't want an extremist Nazi like me speaking there. These are Jews that I'm speaking on their behalf, all of whom, whether it be 1 week later, 1 month later, 1 year later, will all write to me and say, "Ooh, my son just got threatened. Now I get it." Here's some more parasitic thinking. Forget about the other. Just look at this very progressive guy. He's a Norwegian man. By the way, all of these, they're all referenced. You can go check them, right? It's not difficult to know if I'm being veridical in my examples. He was sodomized by a Somali immigrant in Norway. The Norwegian judiciary gave him a very light sentence, the Somali rapist, and then they were deporting him. Do you know what their reaction of, this is his description, he's a strong feminist and anti-racist. He had huge existential conundrum. He felt profoundly guilty that his sodomizer was now going to be deported to Somalia, where he wouldn't be able to live out his full potential. You don't have to be a fancy evolutionary psychologist to know that that's not a evolutionary-based emotion. Most people, when they are sodomized, are probably unable to muster that level of empathy to their sodomizer. But when you're super progressive, trained at Wellesley and Oberlin, you can. This one got me in trouble with my university because I shared literally the Nobel Foundation released this thing, right? And so in the context of a conversation that I was having, I shared the fact that Jews constitute 0.2% of humanity, but they have roughly 25% of the Nobel Prizes. Muslims constitute roughly 25% of humanities, and they have many fewer Nobel Prizes. That's not a statement of supremacy. One way we could look at it as, hey, are there certain cultural values that causes, so we don't have to talk genetics or anything. Is there anything inherent in Jewish upbringing that might cause them to excel in academia? And certainly, my supervisor, who knows a bit about my family, knows about some of the expectations that come in my family. And let me share one of them with you. I did an undergrad. I'm saying this not to talk about my CV, but it's relevant to the story. I did an undergrad in mathematics and computer science, so about as technical as you can get. And then I did an MBA with a mini thesis in operations research, which is an applied mathematics field. And then I came to Cornell. But before I came to Cornell, one of my brothers who has lived in Southern California, he's a software guy, was trying to convince me to put on the proverbial suit after my MBA and maybe take a break, work with him for a few years before eventually I might go back to do my PhD. I wasn't really interested. I always wanted to go in academia. But when my mother caught wind that my brother was trying to sing in my ear about possibly, stopping my education, when I returned from Southern California, she took me to a side room and said, I want to talk to you. It was very sort of ominous. I said, well, what's up, Mom? She said, well, I'm hearing that you're thinking about, leaving after your MBA. Do you want people to view you as somebody who dropped out of school? Okay. That's what explains this. Having an undergrad in mathematics and computer science and an MBA and stopping there would have brought great shame to the family. You're an illiterate moron. Now, of course, I didn't go to pursue my MS and PhD at Cornell because I was trying to assuage my mother's fragile ego, but that's the expectation that people have of you. We're less worried about committing daily genocide on other and much more concerned about contributing in a positive way. to the world, whether it be in medicine or art or music or philosophy or academia, and it goes on and on. One of the only places we don't do too well is in soccer. I was hoping to solve that problem, but then I had a career-ending injury. So again, I put this up because cultural values matter. And the obsessive desire for learning within the Jewish tradition, whether it be learning I have here the wife of my rabbi from Cornell, Chana Silberstein, who did her PhD here at the same time as me. We took a course with Professor Russo together. It's just ingrained in you. You have to study always and more. When I gave this talk in Montreal, it was in front of largely a Jewish audience. I mean, every single person that came up to me was neurosurgeon this, PhD classics that, PhD MD this. It's just one after another, after another, after another. Okay. That's why you get those figures. Spend less time calling for the genocidal killing of Jews, and maybe you too can have a few more Nobel Prizes. This one might make some of you feel squirmy in your seats, but it shouldn't. In Britain, over the past 25, 30 years, the reason I'm putting this up is not to marginalize a group of people, but it's to give you a sense of what happens when political correctness becomes a parasitic sting of the spider wasp that zombifies you. So in England, throughout England, up and down England, small cities and big cities, you can do the Google search later where you can read the government reports. It's not me making stuff up. The reason why I say this is because you will usually get some folks on social media say, oh, you're just making this stuff. As if this thing called Google doesn't exist. As if they can't verify everything, right? So there's been what's called grooming rape gangs in Britain at a level that's industrial scale. Thousands and thousands of young, poor British girls, white girls, have been groomed and gang raped and tricked and turned into prostitution by 99% Asian men. Because that's the palatable euphemism for not saying what they may have in common. And so this is just one. This is from, I can't remember if it's, it's the BBC. This is the mugshot with the names of the folks. I'm putting this up because I'm going to get to a parasitic thing at the end, which is maybe going to take your breath away. So here are some of the names of the people. You ready? I'm just going to read a few. Irfan Ahmad, Zahid Hassan, Muhammad Kamir, Muhammad Rizwan Aslam, Nahman Muhammad, Wikas Mahmoud, Muhammad Irfraz, and it goes on. So I put this up and I said, I must have missed the big data analytic class where we try to identify any commonalities. So I don't have the big computational skills to be able to come to a conclusion. Could someone tell me what's common? Do you know what many, many hundreds of people wrote to me is the culprit behind this? Can you say who you think it is? It's not what it should be there. Sorry? The Jews. Yes. Why? Let's see if you've got your parasitic mind fully infected. They're not joking. They're not trolling. They're not being facetious. I put this up. Think about doing a decision-making course, a critical thinking course, a data analysis course. And I say, okay, so it's the Jews. Why? So this is, by the way, before I see if anybody can answer it, this is what I call 6 degrees of Jew. That's the game that I... 6 degrees of Jews of Jew works as follows. I give you a calamity, and you have up to 6 degrees of faux causality to blame the evil juice. So, for example, I could say, an Amazonian frog just died. Go. So you've got 6 that... For most things, it only takes, if you're very entrenched in your neuroparasite, it only takes about 2 or 3 steps. Sometimes it can take a bit more, but certainly by 6, you got your culprit. How is it when 3 Muhammads gang rape your daughter, it's Mordechai that's to blame? 3 M's are replaced by 1 M. 3 Muhammads by 1 Mordechai. Anybody want to take a shot at that? Anybody have an idea? It's because it's Jews who are the puppeteer of the open border policies. Therefore, sure, it might be Muhammad who technically raped your daughter. How did Muhammad get there? So Jew, stop whining with these things. You're the architect of why that happened. So when the outcome of that data solidifies how diabolical the Jew is, Houston, we have a problem. And again, this is a very, very common find. You might say, oh, but these are just trolls on the internet. No, no, they're not. Some of them are even have the audacity to identify who they are because they're fully emboldened. I mean, yes, George Soros is a Hungarian Jew. He is an acolyte of Karl Popper, who's proposed the open society, and therefore all the open immigration that you're seeing is, to the extent that it's a bad thing, is ultimately to be blamed on the Jews. You see this discourse in academia, you see it online, you see it everywhere. I'm not going to mention what this is because I've already said it. Ostrich parasitic syndrome. By the way, the ostrich actually doesn't do this, but it's become an apt metaphor for someone who wishes to deny reality. It's actually worth reading it. So this is the definition that I gave it in The Parasitic Mind. This disorder causes a person to reject realities that are otherwise as clear as the existence of gravity. Sufferers of OPS do not believe their lying eyes. They construct an alternative reality known as unicornia. In such a world, science, reason, rules of causality, evidentiary thresholds, a near infinite amount of data, data analytic procedures, inferential statistics, the epistemological rules inherent to the scientific method, rules of logic, historical patterns, daily patterns, and common sense are all rejected. Instead, the delusional ramblings of an OPS sufferer are rooted in illusory correlations, non-existent causal links, and feel-good progressive platitudes. Ostrich logic is always delivered via an air of haughty moral superiority. And I'll give you in the next page what it looks like exactly. Right here, we have from a very reliable website, but there are other databases if you don't like this website. Because usually when someone doesn't like a reference I give them, it's because that website is infiltrated by Zionists. So you can pick other ones that may not be under Zionist infiltration. But this one comes from a very reliable website that has tracked the number of terror attacks since 9/11 alone in nearly 70 countries. These 70 countries could not be more different from each other in every possible way, racially, economically, ethnically, in every possible way, religiously. Right now, the counter was, when I did the clip, was at 44,609 since 9/11 alone. 44,000. Okay? When the terrorists commit those acts, they usually tell you the exact reason why they're doing it. They will quote the exact verse that justifies why they're doing it. You know what our super smart progressive professors and bien pensant are the good thinkers, the politically correct thinkers. You know what they tell us, those 44,000? Don't listen to what the terrorist quotes. I know better because I've studied anthropology. It's due to lone wolfism. What does that mean? It's due to man-made disasters. It's due to violent video games. I better stop my son from playing those first shooter games. He might join ISIS in Raqqa, Syria. It's because lack of adequate exposure to art. These are not satirical. I give you the reference to each one if you want. And they're from super smart Western people. So which amongst us didn't, if in his childhood was not exposed to Chagall and Picasso, didn't go and join ISIS to throw the gaze off rooftops in Raqqa. Is it possible that someone could be that insane as to argue that lack of adequate exposure to art is what caused some Brussels terrorists to do what they did when they told you why they did what they did? It's due to studying engineering. Well, there must be a lot of future terrorists at Cornell. You've got a pretty vibrant engineering school. I would hate to think what's happening at MIT or Caltech. It's due to beard bullying. So the San Bernardino terrorist said that he was being picked on at work. That's why I keep my beard trim, because I worry that if I grow it a bit more and someone beard bullies me, I might commit a terrorist act. It's due to climate change, right? Bill Nye, the science guy, explained to us, you can go, all those references are in the Parasitic Mind, explained on the Huffington Post that it is very, quite conceivable, and he offered a causal chain of evidence of how the Syrian civil war and the Bataclan Paris terror attacks was due to, you know, CO2 and solar panels and so on. That's what a parasitic mind looks like. And it goes on and on and on. Okay. Here, what I'm not going to spend much time on this, but in a sense, it serves for the people who weren't here yesterday. It's important for me to reintroduce this concept. So in the Parasitic Mind in Chapter 7, I talk about how to seek truth. And I argue that you build unassailable arguments by building nomological networks of cumulative evidence, which means what? It means that I try to find you as many data stemming from as many distinct line of evidence that hopefully proves that my position is veridical. And so yesterday, forgive me for those who were at yesterday's talk, so if I'm trying to prove to you, if what I'm trying to prove to you here is that toy preferences have a sex specificity because of biological reasons, not due to social construction, how would I go about building such a nomological network? Well, I could get you data from developmental psychology that shows you that children who are too young to be socialized already exhibit those sex-specific toy preferences. I can get you data from other species, vervet monkeys, rhesus monkeys, and chimpanzees, showing you that their toy preferences in their species is exactly that of humans. I can get you data from ancient Greece that shows you that the way that children are depicted playing on funerary monuments are exactly those that we see today. I can get you data from non-Western samples that couldn't have been Westernized, where they exhibit the exact same sex specificity. I can get you data from pediatric endocrinology showing you that little girls who suffer from congenital adrenal hyperplasia, it's an endocrinological disorder that masculinizes behavior. Little girls who suffer from this endocrinological disorder have a reversal of their sex-specific toy preferences. They exhibit boy toy preferences. So I can get you data across time periods, across cultures, across species, across methodologies, across theoretical frameworks, across dependent measures, all of which triangulate in a truly tsunami, in an orgiastic tsunami of evidence that it is veridical. It's much more than a literature review. A literature review is much more narrow. I'm studying the link between alcohol consumption and asthma. Well, I might do a literature review on the link between those two. This is a much broader way to build arguments. Well, we can use that approach to, for example, say, well, does a religion promote peace and tolerance, and is it consistent with enlightened values? We don't have to emote louder than someone else. We don't have to be hysterical. I can build you the nomological network using many, many different lines of evidence, and then you could come to your own conclusion. And if you build that nomological network for the question we're asking there, the answer should be pretty obvious to you. I'm almost done, so bear with me. Usually I'm referred to as the happy warrior because I'm more often than not smiling and joking and, you know, being self-deprecating. And one of the reasons, well, the main reason I wrote the happiness book that I did is because many people would write to me and say, what's your secret? Why are you always smiling and happy and jovial? And so I thought, okay, well, maybe I'll take a crack at writing a book on this. Well, I put out a tweet a few months ago that received, I can't remember at last count, it's probably over 15 million views. So the happy warrior is feeling pessimistic. So let me read it for you. You are not going to like this tweet, so turn away if you are likely to be triggered. I'm a very optimistic person. I'm a fighter for Western values and liberties. I'm a dogged defender of science, reason, and common sense. I must say, though, that I'm unsure that the West can recover from its multi-front civilizational suicide. Yes, I've talked about these issues for decades and wrote a book about it, but the past few weeks have crystallized the extent to which the problem has become intractable. It will be a long and ultimately bloody demise, and the West will be the first society in recorded history to fully self-implode due to its parasitic ideological rapture. It is a gargantuan Greek tragedy that will shape the future of humanity. This is not hyperbole. Your grandchildren will pay a very high price for your progressive arrogance rooted in the pursuit of unicornia that only exists in the recesses of deeply flawed, parasitized minds. But let me offer some hopefully optimistic and prescriptive final. I think I only have two more slides. So a call to action, right? If you go see your physician and he or she says you've got this disease, you hopefully don't want it to end there. Well, what are some things that we can do to correct the problem? Well, number one, I say activate your inner honey badger, which is something that I talk about in the last chapter of The Parasitic Mind. The honey badger has been ranked by zoologists as the fiercest animal in the world. It is the size of a small dog, yet it is insanely ferocious. Nobody messes with the honey badger. And here I've got a photo of the honey badger facing down a multitude of adult lions. The lions retreat when they come across the honey badger. Now, what do I mean when I say activate your inner honey badger? Am I saying that you should be violent? Of course not. What I'm saying is, if there are a set of principles that you strongly believe in, that you can articulate why they are correct, then maybe don't walk away from offering your insights, right? The natural tendency for most people, regrettably, is to say, I don't want to put my head on the chopping blocks. I don't want to be the next in the guillotine line. And so everybody is quiet. Oh, I'm sure Gad Saad has a big enough mouth. He'll take care of it for us. But no, most people, the silent majority, hate this stuff and agree with pretty much most of the stuff that I say. But they don't want to be the ones. I may not be invited to the cool kids party, right? I'm not tenured yet. I'm worried. What? Maybe I'll talk after tenure. Well, I'm tenured, but I'm going up for full professor. Well, I'm full professor, but I'm going for chaired professor. Well, I'm chaired professor, but I may not get the research grant. Oh, now it's too late for me to talk. I'm retired. So there's always a reason for you not to talk. I'm not made that way. I mean, I was trained beautifully by my advisor here and Tom Gilbert within the behavioral decision theory framework, and you know, I did some good stuff there. But I decided that where I think I could make the biggest impact in my academic research was in evolutionary psychology. When most people said, what's this evolutionary psychology? Who wants to argue that consumers and economic decision makers are driven by Darwinian forces? That's insane. That's Nazi talk. And I said, I don't give a shit. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to be authentic to what I think is the truth. So even in my academic work, not just in my public engagement, I decided that I'm just going to go where I think the wind takes me, where truth takes me. So if we can all find a way to find our spine and activate our inner honey badger, we would certainly be in a better place. We would advance the discourse. Number two, this is for those of you who are ever facing political choices that you have to make. The don't get drunk by smelling the cork of the wine bottle is a translation from Arabic. Let me explain what it means. Arabic is a very beautiful and poetic language that's very flowery, so there are all kinds of sayings in Arabic that I try to bring into in my English discourse. So if this were the cork of the wine bottle, and I just smell it and I start getting drunk, that means I'm of weak constituency, right? I didn't need to go through the hard work of drinking the wine, and I'm already drunk. Well, apply that now to cognitive weakness, right? This guy, and I'll share what I think of him. this orgiastic buffoon, this walking instantiation of every parasitic idea that I talk about in my book, is tall. He's got beautiful hair. He's dreamy. Look how I'm getting drunk. I'm getting drunk at the cork of Trudeau. On the other hand, look at, I'm going to now smell the cork of Trump. Trump is ugly. He's cantankerous. He's vulgar. He repulses me. I'm not saying this. I'm saying this as the cool kids at Oberlin. Okay? What did I just say? I didn't say I don't like Trump because of his monetary policy, his immigration policy. I didn't mention any policies. I didn't say I love Trudeau because of his policies. I either loved Obama or hated Obama or loved Trump or hated Trump because I got drunk. That's literally how almost everyone in the electorate makes decisions. Okay? So don't get drunk by smelling the cork of the wine bottle. As a matter of fact, I've sat down using the Socratic method with some colleagues and I say, okay, you hate such and such politician. Okay, let's analyze it. What's your view on immigration? So then the person says that. I say, ooh, that sounds more like the guy you hate. Ooh. What's your position on freedom of speech? Ooh, that, right? But they didn't have to think about all those things. This guy's repulsive and disgusting. He's an existential threat. This guy is tall and lanky. Obama has a mellifluous voice. He's got a radiant smile. He seems progressive. I'm a good person. I don't vote based on skin color. Therefore, I vote Obama. I'm a good person. I may hate every single word that comes out of his platitudinous mouth, but my God, is he lanky and has a pretty smile. That's how people think. Now, if we're going to put it in the language of, you know, psychology, you could talk about cosmetic cues versus substantive cues. You could talk about the elaboration likelihood model. We can make it as academic as you want. So make decisions based on real principles rather than on cosmetic things. And then, of course, as relating to certainly the university campus, I only have one more slide, I think, after this. Make your donation dollars count. Harvard now is, of course, panicking because some of its billionaire Jewish donors are saying, yeah, this is not going to work anymore. You know that $400 million that I earmarked for you guys? F you. Suddenly the administrators now are listening. They didn't listen when they read Parasitic Mind because, oh, okay, whatever, it's some fancy book. But money talks. If you ever cancel a speaker at your university, there goes my $400 million. Yes, Bill Ackman, sir, I hear you. Right? So, but even if you're only making $500 donation or $1,000, make it contingent on the university adhering to certain deontological principles. And then, last slide, which is another one of those tweets that got a lot of attention. How to save the West. In order for the West to win the civilizational battle, it must proudly and unequivocally defend Western values. It must reject an idea pathogen that I talk about in The Parasitic Mind, which is reject cultural relativism and the unicornia vision of multiculturalism. By the way, that doesn't mean that you don't want to live in a ethnically diverse society. Multiculturalism is actually a political philosophy that is actually cancerous. Cultural relativism says, who are we to judge if another society cuts off the clitorises of 5-year-old girls? Well, I'll judge it because I have enough of a moral compass to recognize what is deontologically right or not. Cultural relativism makes me impotent to make that cultural judgment. It says, you have no right to judge the cultural systems of others. Recommit to individual dignity over the celebration of collective identity politics. I present myself to the world, notwithstanding the fact that I obviously talked about my background here because it's relevant to the talk. I present to the world as Gad Saad, not as part of some minority or oppressed thing, right? There is no indigenous science. There is no Lebanese Jewish science. There is no reason we should give awards based on what your gender orientation is. So return to individual dignity and to an ethos of meritocracy. Recognize that all cultures are not equal. Recognize that all religious beliefs are not equally consistent with Western values. Recognize that all immigrants are not equally likely to assimilate and adopt Western values. Nothing could be clearer. recognize that immigrants who espouse intolerable values that seeks to destroy our civilizations will be deported en masse. Implement a rational immigration policy that recognizes the importance of cultural homophily, which is a fancy way of saying choosing immigrants who hail from cultures that possess similar values to those of the host nations. Homophily is something that you see in a myriad of ways. So, for example, in evolutionary psychology, you have assortative mating. You mate with people, birds of a feather flock together. Your marriage is much more likely to be successful and long-lasting if you marry someone who shares the same foundational values as you do. So in that case, opposites attract doesn't work. It might work well for short-term mating. It doesn't work well for long-term mating, right? So it doesn't take a rocket scientist to get that if you bring in 5 million people into your society that don't share these cultural definitional values, you're going to have problem. Germany is now saying, uh-oh. Sweden is now saying, uh-oh. Netherlands saying, uh-oh. Denmark saying, uh-oh. But I told them, I warned them, it doesn't, but it's because they were blinded by their progressive utopia. Exhibit zero tolerance for seditious belief systems. Such systems can be criminalized if they constitute an existential threat to our freedoms and liberties. Hopefully in the future, I won't have to come back to Cornell to talk about increased Jew hatred. Thank you very much. I mean, not specifically Middle East Studies Department. I've given similar talks or made similar points where I know that there are Middle Eastern students or just people there, but not uniquely that.
I guess my real question is, have you given a talk to people who would perhaps protest your talk?
Well, maybe I should knock on wood. I actually thought maybe I should feel insulted and offended that I'm not important enough that I don't get protested. But I thought that coming to Woke Central at Cornell, there was going to be a lot more protest, and things have gone very smoothly. So who knows? Frankly, given how outspoken I am in my positions, although I think they're very rational, reasonable ones, but in today's zeitgeist, given people say a lot less than I do. So by Tuesday morning, I've probably tweeted 100 things that are more controversial than all the people that you know have been canceled. And many people have asked me, so what's the secret to why you haven't been canceled? I think it's multifactorial. There are several reasons. I think because I do have a discipline in that the message that I don't attack, for example, individual Muslims. I attack certain tenets of Islam. By being disciplined in doing that, it makes it harder for somebody to come after you. The fact that, although I didn't do it, I did it a bit today, but the fact that I use humor helps to, soften the blow. So there are all sorts of both cosmetic and substantive reasons that makes it somewhat more difficult to cancel me. I also am someone who does my homework. I build these nomological networks. As I explained yesterday in the Parasitic Mind lecture, I build these nomological networks before I go into a hostile room. So if you're going to debate me, you better have your nomological network ready. If you just scream and shout and emote and go into a fetal position, you're not going to win the debate. So I'm very disciplined in knowing what I know and knowing what I don't know. I don't thread into territory that I don't feel comfortable defending. Because of all that, I actually get much fewer protests than you would expect. Although, on the negative, I do get an astounding number of threats. So I've had, as I explained in yesterday's lecture, at several points in my Concordia career, I've had to be accompanied by security when I'm going to teach a class. Now imagine how sinister that is. In the 21st century, a professor in Canada has to go, I've had to have filed police reports with the detectives and the whole thing. That's probably the old canary in the coal mine. Now, luckily for me, I'm not easily intimidated. Maybe it's I should be more afraid, but I'm maybe because of my personal history, I'm simply not going to hopefully let these societies turn into the societies from which I fled. That's, by the way, one of the reasons why some of the staunchest defenders of the Western tradition are usually immigrants. Because those immigrants have sampled from the buffet of societies that exist. And they know that the West is an outlier, is an anomaly in recorded history. So we've been elsewhere, and then we come here, we go, this is unbelievable, and therefore we want to defend what's here, given that we escaped from there.
Going back to 2 years ago, to the hostage situation in Colleyville, Texas, when the synagogue was taken over and the hostages were taken, I recall that the terrorist was able to infiltrate the synagogue by dressing as a homeless man and taking advantage of the rabbi's charity. Now, is that charitable behavior parasitic?
Right, no. So I don't know that particular case. It doesn't come to mind, but your general question applies. That's actually the topic of my next book, which is tentatively titled Suicidal Empathy, right? So, of course, empathy is an emotion that we've evolved because it serves certain evolutionary functional reasons, right? So it's fine. The problem with empathy is when it misfires, right? So just like earlier today at lunch, I was talking to some people. If you look at OCD, for example, OCD is the maladaptive firing of an otherwise adaptive process, because OCD is about scanning the environment for threats. Let's say I have germ contamination fear, so I wash my hands. The average person who doesn't suffer from OCD tends to that threat, and then the warning flag goes down and I go on in my day. But when I suffer from OCD, that warning flag is hyperactive. So I wash my hands, then I try to walk away, then I wash my hands again, then I try to walk away. So now I'm stuck in this ritualized loop for 8 hours. If I go check whether the back door is locked, if I check once and the flag goes down, it's finished, and that's fine. But if I spend 8 hours checking it so that I don't show up to work, then we're going to have a problem. My OCD becomes dysfunctional. So empathy, when calibrated properly, is perfectly fair. We like to think that all people here are empathetic. That's wonderful. But there are ways by which empathy misfires, certainly within the progressive calculus, where you end up with public policy that is disastrous. So that's really the topic. You're getting a preview of my next book. Thank you. Yes. It does. It is protected. As I explained yesterday, I'm an absolutist when it comes to freedom of speech, and that I support the right of arguably the most offensive speech possible, which is Holocaust denial, right? For obvious reasons, it's terribly, it's inaccurate and it's offensive, and yet I support that right. So the question then becomes whether in his delivery that could be construed as direct incitement to violence. If yes, then it should not be allowed. If no, then as regrettable as his speech is, I would say he has to be kept here. Probably not. It would have to be, because then it becomes a slippery slope of anything that I said today could be construed as direct incitement against a Muslim student, right? So it has to be a very direct, clear incitement. So, as I mentioned yesterday, you can criticize Judaism all you want in the most feverish ways. That's good. That's fine. If you say, hey, you know the synagogue at the corner of Buffalo and State Street, when they come out from services at 6, let's go and kill them, or then that becomes a problem. So in his case, it's a bit of a fuzzy case, but I would err on the conservative side of keeping him. Anything else?
I'm just curious, can you speak to how your colleagues react, respond to your outspoken?
So by colleagues specifically at my university or the greater academia?
Both.
At Concordia, as I was explaining to my former doctoral supervisor, there is an entente whereby they leave me be and they pretend that I don't exist. But there is a office, undoubtedly, I'm being facetious but almost literal, there is an office in the administration building called the GAD-SAD problem, okay? So the colleagues, I'm very cordial with them, very friendly, there's no problem, but they certainly don't go out of their way to advertise my accolades. They certainly don't go out of their ways to make my reality at Concordia. So I've now been denied. I held the highest professorship at Concordia for 10 years. For it to be renewed would have been a no-brainer because my dossier has only improved since. And now I know for a fact I'll never get it again. So the way they get to me is they hopefully make my life sufficiently miserable in a passive-aggressive way that I'll just scream, I quit. Now, when it comes to the greater academia, so there are two ways to answer this. Many universities have tried through the years to hire me, bring me on, and then usually there would be a mutiny of rank and file who say, oh, no way, not over my dead body. But I think, based on the anecdotal stuff that I see, I receive, I mean, literally probably thousands of messages from professors. I'm just going to read for you the template. Dear Professor Saad, my name is so-and-so. I'm a professor at so-and-so in such-and-such field. Then there is a paragraph or two of absolutely lovely compliments. And then it ends with the following line. And in case you were thinking about reading my letter on your show, please don't mention my name. And then I write back, Dear Professor so-and-so, thank you for your lovely words. They're very touching. Don't you think that the last sentence of your email is why we are currently in the trouble that we're in? And then that usually jolts them. Oh, yeah, I know, but I'm going for tenure. I'm associate professor. I'm full professor. I'm going for grant. So I think that I can't give you what the number is. I think there is an extraordinary number of professors that are yay, yay, gad, but very few who come out publicly. And certainly many fewer than there are out there. The UCL lady.
Thank you very much again for speaking to us this evening. I wanted to ask what you think the future of academia is in this climate. You know, you just touched on then a lot of the issues that we're seeing with people not wanting to step up, not wanting to say anything. And I wonder where you think we're going to end up.
The future of academia? Is that I missed that word.
Yes,
future.
Academia,
yes. Look, I love academia. It's ingrained in my DNA. So any criticism that I have of academia stems from my love of academia in a general sense. There are some endemic problems in academia that really need to be redressed. I don't think that the university is in trouble. Many of my colleagues who are in the free thinker ecosystem believe that, you know, we should erase all universities and start afresh. I don't think that that's reasonable. Cornell is not going to go anywhere. But we certainly have to change the ecosystem in academia. It has to be that professors can speak openly without worrying that any given syllable might get them in trouble. It has to be that you can do any... that's why we have tenure. And yet most people are so afraid of their shadow that it really is cancerous. I know that most of you have heard of these problems, but you can't imagine the kinds of letters I receive. Dear Professor Saad, this is an actual letter. I was working in the cognitive psychology lab of this professor. I was a first author on the paper. Then he heard that I said something complimentary on Donald Trump to my friends. Now my name is off that paper, and I don't think I can stay in the lab. Are you taking any doctoral students? That's not Yemen. That's not Pakistan. That's not communist China. It's not North Korea. It's everywhere. So how many of these cases must be existing for people to say, this is not good. We probably have to fight against this. So I'm hopeful that the pendulum will, you know, swing the other way, but it's going to be a long battle because these parasitic ideas, depending on the parasitic idea, took between 40 to 90 years for it to become entrenched within academia. I hope it won't take that long to get rid of it, but it's a long battle.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to add something to that answer. You can help Cornell be saved if you think there was a reasonable, logical, evidence-based discussion here about anti-Semitism or Jew hatred, whatever you want to call it. You can help Martha Pollack, President Pollack, answer the questions that the House Ways and Means Committee sent to her to ask her about anti-Semitism in the letter. I don't think she's given a good explanation yet. So I personally am going to send a video of this talk to her. She hasn't often opened my emails. So please feel free to also send a video of this talk to help her answer those questions and perhaps save Cornell from losing its federal funding.
Thank you, Randy.
Any other questions? What's your email address?
Mine?
What's hers?
Hers. Oh.
I can't remember if it's present at Cornell.
Thank you,
Oswald,
for
the
talk.
Thank you.
And on the those suicides or cultural suicides that the Western civilization is currently en route to, if not reversed, you know, sometimes it's said that you don't know what you have until you lose it.
Yes.
And I think your statement that most of the people who are at the vanguard defending Western civilization are outsiders.
Yes.
Who have experienced something else. And I'm one of those you know, people. So those of us who are outsiders actually have something to compare the Western civilization.
Exactly.
But those who are within the Western civilization do not have something else to compare.
Sure.
What they have. So they do not really know or even cherish or value what they have because they do not have something else
sure.
to compare it with. How would you help someone who is within that kind of box to really see reasons to consciously compare other civilizations with the Western civilization and then try to protect what they have?
Well,
secondly,
yeah.
In providing solution to Jew hatred, is there something that the Jew could do to protect herself or himself from being hated? For example, maybe failing or some other things like that. So they seem to be overachievers. And it seems that is one of the reasons, based on the data that you have given. And also, some texts, some religious texts that may support, you know, the hatred of the Jew.
You mean that that demonstrates Jew hatred in those religious texts? Is that what you're asking?
Sorry, I didn't get that.
You're saying, are there some religious texts that support Jew hatred in those canonical texts? Is that what you're asking?
I mean, it's something that I should know based on the context I'm coming from.
Yeah.
So that is not the question I'm asking.
Okay.
But is there something that the Jew could do, not just what?
Well, you may not like my answer, but it's not a flippant one. The best revenge is a life well lived, right? And so the way that I walk, despite the fact that I'm physically not tall, is I walk tall, right? Walk with dignity. Be proud of who you are, of what you've achieved. There is no way by which I could do a dance so that you could love me more, right? Because I deserve to be respected and loved, and I don't need to acquiesce. I don't mean to your hatred, but to the hatred that, right? It's the guy who said, but you're not a Jew. Getting to know me can also help, right? One of the problems that we have in hatred in general, not just Jew hatred, is you don't know the other. The other is diabolical. But when you sit down with a dinner, and that's why, for example, I get upset when people say, oh, you're hating Muslims. But no, my culture is Arabic. I speak Arabic at home. We eat Arabic food. We listen to Arabic. So when I sit down with those guys on the soccer field, then they say, you know what? I think I heard wrong things about Jews because there seems to be really cool ones. So I think it's just talking to people, getting to know them, removing that othering border, and hopefully that can help. But to your earlier point about it's the immigrants who defend the most, I made that point earlier, which is, you know, take someone like Ayaan Hirsi Ali, who's a Somali immigrant who left, who's an ex-Muslim, right? You know that she's been canceled at almost every school where she tries to go to speak because the Western white person from Oberlin knows Islam more than the Somali woman who comes from 1,000 years of Islam. That's the progressive arrogance. So we don't want to listen to this Somali bigot. She's a racist. I know better. I'm a white liberal person from Oberlin. And so that's how you fight back, right? You speak out. Be a honey badger. And then hopefully that instigate or triggers the courage of others and we can solve the problem. How are you, sir?
Thank you so much for the speech again. My question, I hope, won't be interpreted in a way where I'm praising authoritarian systems. But on authoritarian systems, we frequently have a very unapologetic society, even for things that they probably should be apologizing for, right? Like case with China, Russia. They almost always take the position of strength and such. And in the West, where we do have a sense that we have a moral right, nevertheless, it seems instead of taking a position of strength, we glamorize features that would be associated with the lack of strength. I believe Slavoj Žižek, Slovenian Marxist philosopher, he was actually, I thought he really hit the nail on that one, where he said that white liberals seeks in a sense of power in self-humiliation and making himself or themselves, I don't know, precipitous weak and not hurting anyone and apologizing. So from both from evolutionary perspective and from the perspective of us, well, I think we more or less all agree that we have a better system than authoritarian regimes in China and Russia, right? Are we victims of our own success, and what explains this type of behavior? Right, when a lot of Jews in America specifically, right, they do go to Palestine protests and they do
yes.
chant from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, which causes current investments in the same with the queers and such and such. So, thank you.
Right. So I'll focus on your point how. Many of the virtues that we view as laudable in the West are viewed differently in other societies. I actually wrote an article on this, and I called it, I proposed a new concept called cultural theory of mind. Okay? So theory of mind is a principle that is fundamental to human sociality. What's theory of mind? It's my being able to put myself in the mind of another so that we can have a proper discussion, exchange, right? I need to have the ability to say, well, what do I think she may know so that I can talk to her, right? By the way, one of the ways that you diagnose autism in very young children is you give them a test that gauges whether they have theory of mind or not, and autistic children fail the theory of mind test. Now, why am I talking about all this? The West suffers from lack of cultural theory of mind, or what are also called cultural blindness, meaning they think that the values that they view as honorable are those that other societies view as honorable, and it's the exact opposite of that. You, meaning the West, infinite, unequivocal, magnanimity as a positive, what do you think the Middle Eastern mindset reads? What's the word?
Weakness.
You view compassion, they view weakness. You view empathy, they view weakness. Now, that doesn't mean that people in the Middle East are not empathetic and compassionate and kind, but those acts that shape, say, public foreign policy, that in the West, I can tap myself on the back and go, look what a magnanimous, compassionate, empathetic person I am. All that the Eastern mindset reads is weak, weak, weak. And I'm often dumbfounded when I see some of the positions taken by Westerners when dealing with those other societies. Because it really is akin of one person speaking in English, the other person speaking in Cantonese. We can't have a conversation. We speak different languages. So that's what happens with cultural theory of mind. And that's probably going to be something that I discuss in greater detail in the next book. So thank you for that question.
I'm just thinking that at Cornell, we don't have to worry about the canary in the coal mine because we're trying to shut down all the coal mines. And that's our solution. And I want to thank Dad for giving such a great series of talks.
Thank you.